Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org. The podcast you're about to hear was recorded in 2011. I'm Chris Higashi, Program Manager of the Washington Center for the Book at the Seattle Public Library. Welcome to the Central Library. We are very pleased to welcome Anne Enright back to the library. She was here a few years ago to read from her novel, The Gathering. So thank you first to Elliott Bay Book Company for inviting us to host and co-present this event. We also thank the Irish Heritage Club and Nancy Speaker, the president, who is here this evening. Also, John Keane, the honorary consul of Ireland. We also thank the Seattle Times for generous promotional support for library programs, our author series sponsor, Gary Kunis, and finally, the Seattle Public Library Foundation, which this year is celebrating its 30th anniversary. Okay, so here's Karen Maeda Allman from Elliott Bay Book Company to introduce our special guest. Thanks.
Good evening, and thank you for coming. And I'm very pleased to welcome Anne Enright back to Seattle, back to the Northwest. She's a graduate of the Lester B. Pearson College of the Pacific, which is a small college on Vancouver Island. So she's familiar with our part of the world from before she was doing her book tours. And she also studied at the University of East Anglia with Angela Carter. And she's previously worked, before she was a novelist and essayist, she worked as a television reporter and a director in her native Ireland. Her writing has appeared in The New Yorker, Irish Times, Parish Review, Granta, Dublin Review, and many other places. And she's a semi-regular contributor to the London Review of Books. Her first novel, The Wig My Father Wore, was the first of about nine books so far, including historical novels, essays, and many prize-winning novels of other sorts. She's the winner of the Davy Byrne Irish Writing Award in 2004, the Royal Society of Authors Encore Prize, and as Chris mentioned, the 2007 Man Booker Prize for her novel, The Gathering. Tonight she'll read from her most recent novel, The Forgotten Waltz, and it's a very different sort of narrative than any of the books that came before. She's not only telling the story of one particular Irish girl who finds herself in sort of interesting circumstances, I'll leave it as that, but also, I think, raises some important questions about a whole class of people who have fallen into a type of life during the recent Irish boom. And you can kind of feel it kind of rising, and you can also feel the kind of end of this, because we kind of know where Ireland is going now, and actually this reflects on some of the things that are happening in the rest of the world, including right here in Seattle. Please join me in welcoming to the Seattle Public Library Anne Enright.
Thank you very much for that introduction. It's lovely to be back here in rainy Seattle. No rain. See, it's all an exaggeration. I'm going to read you two short sections from The Forgotten Waltz. The first one is at the very beginning of the book and should be self-explanatory. And then I'll tell you a little bit about the second piece and read that. So this is the first chapter after the preface, and it's called There Will Be Peace in the Valley. I met him in my sister's garden in Enniskerry. That is where I saw him first. There was nothing fated about it, though I put in the late summer light and the view. I put him at the bottom of my sister's garden in the afternoon, at the moment the day begins to turn. Half five, maybe. It is half past five on a Wicklow summer Sunday when I see Sean for the first time. There he is, where the end of my sister's garden becomes uncertain. He's about to turn around, but he doesn't know this yet. He is looking at the view, and I am looking at him. The sun is low and lovely, He is standing where the hillside begins its slow run down to the coast, and the light is at his back, and it is just that time of day when all the colours come into their own. It's some years ago now. The house is new, and this is my sister's housewarming party, or first party, a few months after they moved in. The first thing they did was take down the wooden fence to get their glimpse of the sea. So the back of the house sits like a missing tooth in the row of new homes, exposed to the easterly winds and to curious cows, a little stage set for this afternoon of happiness. They have new neighbours in and old pals and me with a few cases of wine and the barbecue they put on their wedding list but ended up buying themselves. It sits on the patio, a green thing with a swivelling bucket of a lid, and my brother-in-law, Shay, I think he even wore the apron, waves wooden tongs over lamb steaks and chicken drumsticks while cracking cans of beer high in the air with his free hand. Fiona keeps expecting me to help because I am her sister. She passes with an armful of plates and shoots me a dark look. Then she remembers that I'm a guest and offers me some Chardonnay. Yes, I say, yes, I'd love some, thanks. And we chat like grown-ups. The glass she fills me is the size of a swimming pool. It makes me want to cry to think of it. It must have been 2002. There I was, just back from 3 weeks in Australia, and mad, just mad, into Chardonnay. My niece Megan must have been 4, my nephew nearly 2. Fantastic, messy little items who look at me like they're waiting for the joke. They have friends in too. It's hard to tell how many kids there are running around the place. I think they're being cloned in the downstairs bathroom. A woman goes in there with one toddler and she always comes out fussing over two. I sit beside the glass wall between the kitchen and garden. It really is a lovely house. And I watch my sister's life. The mothers hover around the table where the kids' food is set, while out in the open air, men sip their drinks and glance skywards as though for rain. I end up talking to a woman who is sitting beside a plate of chocolate Rice Krispie cakes and working her way through them in a forgetful sort of way. They have mini marshmallows on top. She goes to pop one in her mouth, then she pulls back in surprise. "Oh, pink," she says. I don't know what I was waiting for. My boyfriend, Connor, must have been dropping someone off or picking them up. I can't remember why he wasn't back. He would have been driving. He usually drove so I could have a few drinks, which was one of the good things about Connor, I have to say. These days it's me who drives, though that's an improvement too. And I don't know why I remember the chocolate Rice Krispies, except that, oh, pink, seemed like the funniest thing I'd ever heard. And we ended up weak with laughter, myself and this nameless neighbour of my sister's. She in particular so crippled by mirth, you couldn't tell if it was appendicitis or hilarity had her bent over. In the middle of which, she seemed to keel off her chair a little. She rolled to the side while I just kept looking at her and laughing. Then she hit the ground running and began a low charge out through the glass door and towards my brother-in-law. The jet lag hit. I remember the strangeness of it, this woman lumbering straight at Shay while he cooked on, the hissing meat, the flames, me thinking, is this night time? What time is it anyway? While the chocolate Rice Krispie cake died on my lips. The woman stooped as if to tackle Shay by the shins. But when she rose, it was with a small, suddenly buoyant child in her arms, and she was saying, out of there, all right, out of there. The child looked about him, indifferent, more or less, to this abrupt change of scene. 3, maybe 4 years old. She set him down on the grass and went to hit him. At least I thought so. She raised a hand to him and then suddenly back at herself as though to clear a wasp from in front of her face. How many times do I have to tell you? Shay lifted an arm to crack a beer and the child ran off and the woman just stood there, running her wayward hand through her hair. That was one thing. There were others. There was Fiona, her cheeks a hectic pink, her eyes suddenly wet from the sheer la, la, la of pouring wine and laughing gaily and being a beautiful mother /hostess in her beautiful new home. And there was Connor, my love, who was late. It's 2002, and already none of these people smoke. I sit on my own at the kitchen table and look for someone to talk to. The men in the garden seem no more interesting than they did when I arrived, in their short-sleeved shirts, and something about their casual trousers that still screams slacks. I'm just back from Australia. I remember the guys you see along Sydney Harbour Front at lunchtime, an endless line of them, running men, tanned and fit, men you could turn around and follow without knowing that you were following them, the same way you might pick up a goddamn Rice Krispie cake and not know that you are eating it until you spotted the marshmallow on the top. Oh, pink. I really want a cigarette now. Fiona's children have never seen one, she told me. Megan burst into tears when an electrician lit up in the house. I pull my bag from the back of the chair and idle my way across the threshold, past Shay, who waves a piece of meat at me, through rain-bleached tricycles and cheerful suburbanites, down to where Fiona's little rowan tree stands, tethered to its square stake, and the garden turns to mountainside. There's a little log house here for the kids, made out of brown plastic. A bit disgusting, actually. The logs look so fake, they might as well be moulded out of chocolate or some kind of rubberized shit. I lurk behind this yoke, and I'm so busy making this seem a respectable thing to do, leaning into the fence, smoothing my skirt, furtively rooting in my bag for smokes, that I do not see him until I light up. So my first sight of Sean, in this, the story I tell myself about Sean, takes place at the beginning of my first exhalation. His body, the figure he makes against the view, made hazy by the smoke of a long-delayed Marlborough light. Sean. He is, for a moment, completely himself. He's about to turn around, but he doesn't know this yet. He will turn around and see me as I see him, and after this, nothing will happen for many years. There's no reason why it should. It really feels like nighttime. The light is wonderful and wrong. It's like I have to pull the whole planet around in my head to get to this garden and this part of the afternoon and to this man who is the stranger I sleep beside now. So, clearly doomed. Clearly doomed. Gina has spotted Sean. There's another kind of cheerful suburban afternoon on a beach in British Bay, south of Dublin, at Fiona's mobile home, which costs 100 grand. That's euros now. And then there's a very unfortunate one-night stand in a conference in Switzerland, in Montreux. They're both in the same kind of business. Anyway, this drab event takes place, and Gina runs away from it, and there's no intention of having another nightstand. But, of course, there will be another nightstand, and then another nightstand as well. And then why not one more stand after that? When Gina, although she has no intentions of sleeping with Sean again, invites him into her company to be a management consultant. She works in IT. So the affair lurches on. It's never seemingly intentional, and it certainly doesn't feel, as it were, destined, the way that first glimpse of Sean seems to carry a burden of fate. But they do end up together, and the story is written from the day it set. It's February the 6th, 2009, which is a day of snow in Ireland, was a day of snow in Ireland. Gina is on her own in her late mother's house. Her mother dies, and Sean is off sorting out the flat he bought in Budapest before the arse fell out of the Hungarian forint, as he says. She's thinking back and trying to sort out what's it all about. I'm going to read another little section about Sean's daughter Evie, who's very central to the book and to is the pivot on which the the book turns, and who provides a kind of both a terrible obstacle to Gina and an unexpected grace. So this is some years later. I wonder, will I just start a little bit earlier? I had a mild interest in Evie that day. Megan is now 9, and Evie is around the same age. Megan, her niece. She's back in the house in Enniskerry. The rowan tree is grown, and the view has been blocked by another set of houses at the back. I had a mild interest in Evie that day, seeing as I'd slept with her father, don't you know, but I couldn't figure out which one she was. Gina's now married to Connor. Anyway, the girls Megan had invited were ridiculously large and hard to fathom. They wore oversized party dresses or funky tops. Two at least were in tracksuit bottoms. You couldn't even tell who they thought they were. These people had, besides, no interest in us. They had each other to love. The way they looked at each other was so passionate and shy. I set out the plates with the real linen napkins that Fiona handed me and the real glasses and metal cutlery. I put a jug of sparkling water on the table and another of orange juice, all of which I thought silly. These were big, uncomfortable children, not grown-ups. Throw a bag of tortilla chips at them, I thought, and retire. Who wants lasagna? One girl, a tall, soft creature called Saoirse, raised her hand. She was stuffed into a pink satin dress that a 5-year-old might choose, and under her arm was a haze of golden red hair. I glanced at Fiona, who rolled her eyes in dread. These children weren't growing so much as being replaced. Come and eat. It troubled me quite a bit, actually, the hair. It looked beautiful when it should have been disgusting. And it was twice as disgusting as it should have been when you looked up from it to the big pudding face of the child. I should get out more, I thought. This cannot be as strange as I think it is. And I also thought, something has gone wrong. Then I saw Evie. She revealed herself with a flash of her father's two beautiful eyes. It happened when she looked straight at me, like the opening of a hidden door. She was still a bit puppyish around the chest, but the fat was mostly gone and something else had changed. I mean, apart from everything, but because everything had changed, but something essential had shifted. She looked happy, or not happy so much as connected for once, not so scared. It made me uneasy, the idea that she used to be afraid. I wondered what kind of man I had slept with, how many months ago now, and would he arrive in through the door? 3 months. It was 3 months since Montreux, and I never wanted to lay eyes on Sean Vallely again. I wasn't just mortified, I was actually averse. The thought of speaking to him was slightly soiling, like putting on used clothes after you've had a shower. Even so, I was caught by his daughter. I watched her as though she might hold some key to this man, whose eyes seemed to make more sense on her face than they did on his own. The long black lashes just the same sea grey with a pale sunburst around the pupil of white or gold. I had nothing to say to her. Would you like some juice? I asked as the girls gathered round the table for lasagna and coleslaw, not a pink marshmallow in sight. Yes, please. Oh, look at that great hair. I touched her black curls, which pleased her. Do you dry it yourself? She was moist with sweat. They all were. Sometimes, she said. Or your mum. If I got straighteners, it would be all the way down my back. Well, I said, by which I meant time enough. Sometimes my dad does it, she said. But this was too intimate for me, and I had to move away. After the cake and candles, I took out my iPod and found myself in the middle of a sudden clamour of tweenies demanding Justin Timberlake. Hang on, I said, and obliged the white bud of the earpiece into Evie's ear. As soon as the music came through, they ran off, grabbing for the other earpiece, switching tracks, turning the dial. Hey, 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 said Fiona, before being diverted by the sound of the doorbell. The party was over. I hung back while the parents came, and one after another, the children were called away. In the middle of the confusion, the sound of his voice in the hall brought an unexpected pang, and I turned to pick up wrapping paper at the far end of the room. Evie? He had arrived in the doorway. I was starting to run out of things to clear off the floor when I sensed Evie standing beside me, a little too close, the way children do. "Just give it back," said Sean's voice, though this was what she was already doing, wrapping the wires around the iPod as she held it out towards me. "Thank you, Gina," she said. Gina, no less. "You're welcome," I said. "Good girl." Sean's voice was so cold, it was clear what he really wanted to say. He wanted to say, "Please step away from my child." And this was very unfair. It was so unfair that I turned and looked straight at him. "Oh, hello," I said. He looked just like himself. "Come on," he said, ushering Evie through the doorway. The rudeness was astonishing. But he faltered and turned back for a moment, and the look he gave me then was so mute, so full of things I could not understand, that I almost forgave him. I tried to keep it at bay and failed. When the last small guest was gone and the rubbish bag full of packaging and uneaten lasagna, the thought of him, the fact of him, happened in my chest like a distant disaster. Something snapped or was broken, and I did not know how bad the damage would be. My hands, as they picked up the heavy jug Fiona used for juice, remembered the solid span of his waist under them that night in Montreux. What was it he had said again? "You have lovely skin." It seemed a bit all-purpose at the time. So soft. Why did men need to persuade themselves? Why did they have to have you and make you up at the same time? This I asked myself rather foolishly while holding the thick glass jug in Fiona's open-plan kitchen in Enniskerry, standing on her new limestone floor. The old terracotta floor was all wrong, apparently. I thought about the difference between one man and another when you have your eyes closed. And I said to myself that the difference was enormous. There was no difference greater than the difference between two men when you have your eyes closed. And in my head, I dropped the jug and was devastated by its fall. Fiona was loading the dishwasher. My mother was taking the plates out again and rinsing them under the tap. Megan and Jack had disappeared. I could feel it, still there under my hands, thick blown glass with swirls in the base of cobalt blue. Such a beautiful jug. And then I let it go. Thank you. When I'm describing the book, I say it's a book about a woman who falls in love, or, I mean, it's that it's three books. You take your pick, basically. Or it's about a woman who falls catastrophically in love, because that's what love is. It is a catastrophe. She flings herself into it, as you might fling yourself off a cliff. Or it's a book about a liar and an adulterer and a man stealer and a home wrecker who would rather spend her money on handbags than childcare. Just like me, actually. I mean, who wouldn't rather spend their money on handbags than childcare? So it's pretty much up to the reader which one they choose, and it has amused me no end to see how people have taken it. They take such a burden of their own, or a gift of their own experience and morality to the book and to Gina. And so I try to keep those three books on the go all the time. I try to keep those books poised all along, which requires a kind of flexibility in Gina's voice from the sublime to the mundane quite quickly, as you might see in some of those passages. And Evie is where it's all at. Would anyone like to ask a question? I'm going to repeat the question, apparently, for the purpose of podcasting, in the firm belief that my mother doesn't go online. Hello. Yeah.
Just as
sudden. Yeah, it's more materialistic than some of the rest of the book. Certainly Fiona's house in Enniskerry is a centre of, at one stage Gina says she's the kind of woman who spends more time with her plumber than her husband, or her tiler, because the husband's out working day and night. So their life was very... The question is about the Celtic tiger and its effect on Irish society as had previous in its previous incarnation, and what has happened since. Fiona, who's a very nice person, and Gina's very unfair to her, as she's unfair to Evie and many of the other people in the book, is living quite a materialistic life, but she's also a nice person. I'm a contrarian about the Celtic Tiger. When people ask me during the boom what has been lost in Ireland, I was slightly impatient because Ireland is always going on about what they've lost. So I'd say, what have we lost this time now that we have money? I also was of the opinion that poverty did not make us lovely. The poor but lovely Irish people are poor, and therefore that money would not necessarily spoil us. I was quite happy for Ireland to have money. Analysts of the boom now divided into a respectable, well-earned phase where we were just, hard-working and globally well-placed, and a kind of hectic bubble phase from 2001 on, particularly with reference to house prices. And there was a very strange thing that happened in that decade in Ireland when you were living there. It was quite estranging. It was the feeling that there was a lot of money in the country, but it never came to people you knew particularly. A great sense of optimism, but also a sense that you couldn't criticize, because when The Gathering came out, there was a reaction, so why are you dragging up all this miserable old stuff when we are over that now? Ireland has money. The wounds of our past are in the past and should stay there. And why are you not writing about the boom? Because in Ireland, you're always writing the wrong book. They say, this is a good, it's a nice book, it's a fine book, it's just the wrong book. So I had been thinking about that, and thought that adultery has been a good subject, both in the post-war American authors like Yeats, Cheever, and Updike, and also in the 60s among women in London. I mean, the booms produced different types of work, but I had thought that was a strain I could. So I was ready to write a boom book when the boom went pop. I didn't necessarily have the book. But I started writing this book in February 2009, and that was, as we all know, Lehman's went down in September 2008. And the week before the snow, we had Irish personalities weeping on national TV about the future and what had happened. There was much clamour and shouting and annoying. The strange thing was that in the fabric of everyday life, nobody knew where we were. Everyone knew we were falling. We didn't know what speed we were falling. We didn't know what the bottom was. And as I wrote this book through 2009 and 2010, I was interested to know what would happen if clarity came, if we knew what was going on, how would it affect Gina and the book. But in fact, clarity didn't come until the IMF walked in the door, and just as this, I was finishing the book in November 2010, and then we knew what bottom was. And the funny thing was, the house prices stayed at the top of the market, stayed in a state of perfect denial up there, and there was nothing underneath them. I mean, it was a very, very strange and poignant time. And the snow and the sense of vertigo and falling and beauty in the snow gave me something, agreed with my emotions of the time about falling and all the rest of it. But it seemed that a kind of beauty was also possible, that there was a moment of grace could come creep stealing in. So that was the moment I was looking for when I was writing the book, and it happens towards the end. My husband was going in on the Dart, which runs along the seafront in Dublin, and I think it was in 2009, he said you could get a seat on the Dart with greater ease every week. And by the end of the year, there was no problem getting a seat on the Dart. The station master, now I have the figures, I'm not sure whether it's weekly or daily, the station master was taking footfall statistics through the turnstiles in Bray, the local station. And they went from 12,500 in one August to 2,500 commuters the next year in the space of 12 months. And so these unemployed people were sinking into the streets around me like water into sand. I did not know where they were. But I mean, you heard stories from school, and you heard stories. But I wouldn't privilege the Irish situation, because I know America has had really terribly tough times. So it is another instance of an Irish writer using the local, the parish pump, to try and make something that has a resonance. A wider resonance, that we all know about. And the book is not a straightforward allegory, although there are echoes and resonances throughout. I think if you tie a book up allegorically, you'll kill it, So the situation informs the book, but the book is not about the situation. Now, nobody else will ask me a question, because I'll go on for so long answering it. The question is about my writing process and what my routine would be. Now, I mean, I have no discipline. If I had discipline, I'd be going to the gym 4 times a week. That's discipline. I write all the time, and I write when I can, and I don't go out all that much. And I'm slightly too far away from everywhere to go anywhere. Slightly beached. Occasionally run away to a local shopping center. I haunt the mall. But it's not that interesting. And so I just write all the time. I'm very comfortable and happy writing when it's going well. So when I've no book, everyone gets a bit tired of me. I write at night. Never really write in the morning, unless the book is really cooking and you wake up and... Yes? No. I don't even think globally, I just think about... I mean, I know that... I don't know that house exactly in Enniskerry. I mean, I very rarely I put something in that is incomprehensible. I mean, I put in the Irish names without a bother or, I'm highly particular in the way I write, and I write Hiberno English. I mean, I write Irish nuanced English that is very heavily influenced. Sometimes even deliberately, consciously influenced by the Gaelic tradition. Particularly the Bardic poets, the 18th century and 19th centuries. So. It's a beautiful resource to have. And people ask me about being an Irish writer all the time, and I don't talk enough about the language, which is a very vibrant instrument in everywhere. But people talk about the oral tradition in Ireland as though people in New York didn't talk to each other. I mean, there are oral traditions everywhere, and people tell stories everywhere, and there are great words to be found everywhere. But there is a kind of vigour to some of the... Some Irish people's speech that's really useful to me. And people also note the ability of the Irish writer to be lyrical, sometimes to their own detriment. too lyrical. You don't want to turn it into gloop. But somehow the accent allows that, perhaps because of our tradition of song or whatever, allows you to rhapsodize slightly. Yeah. The question is whether I knew I was going to write it in the first person from Gina's point of view. I had a narrator who dropped away. I only checked this now before I came out to America. Because people always ask me about beginning, so I looked at the very first words, which are always truly awful that you type for the book. And I had a narrator that was slightly modelled on the narrator of The Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad, who is a figure who just tells the story. He doesn't really exist except he's in the dusk, I think, sitting in the boat telling this awful story. So I had a similar type third-person narrator who basically said they were going to tell a terrible story, but which turned out to be a wonderful story after all. And that narrator died an easy death early on, and I was scrabbling around inside Gina's voice early on. I mean, the next book, I'm going to look to a different challenge. Because this time I had so much fun with a different kind of unreliability to Veronica's. So she's a kind of answer to, I mean, Veronica is a character in The Gathering. She's a kind of answer to Veronica in many ways. The really sad thing about The Gathering for me, and it's a truly sad book for which I apologize, but this book is full of off-key desire and very unpleasant sexuality. It's stained by, you know, many sexual references. Veronica's the narrator. But we have no idea at the end of the book what she desires. So I thought, first of all, I'm going to have a narrator who really knows what she wants. So that was Gina to an extent. And there was something else about the two of them which occurred to me, which I have now forgotten, which may come back to me. But they are somehow images of each other. Oh yeah, her unreliability is because she's realizing things as she speaks. Which I do all the time. I say something and then I know that's sort of true. You know, or that's mostly true, or that's really true, or that's not true at all, but it's not until I say it that I know. And so that's pretty much Gina talking about the relationship. The truth of it emerges slowly through as she talks it. My favorite color is blue. I wouldn't be able to answer the second question. My reading changes radically through various life phases. I used to eat books, and now I kind of nibble through them really slowly. And I tend to avoid what's selling now, because that's a bit like work. You know, reading a book to see what's happening now is very, like, it gets you into an idea of market, which is probably bad for your own work. So I've just been picking up books that I haven't picked up over the last decade. So there was one called Eucalyptus by Murray Bale, who's an Australian, and it's a great, fab little book, folkloric kind of book, about a man who plants every known variety of eucalyptus in Australia. Then I read Cloud Atlas by David Mitchell, which surely everyone has read, or will read now that Halle Berry is going to be in the movie, which really annoyed me. Not that I wanted to be in the movie, but you know, that David Mitchell's got a movie with Halle Berry in it. Oh, it's too many ways to be jealous, really. And that's wonderful. It's one of the... That's a fantastic book, pure pleasure. And I'm just finishing Gilead by Marilyn Robinson. These are all wonderful books. It's very easy to find books that are on your long backlist, you know? I'm not saying you shouldn't buy books that are out now. I'm just saying I'd rather write them than necessarily read them because of the business I'm in. Yes, at the back. Literature. Yeah. What do I think? Do I think that's wrong or right?
Well,
I have great faith in the novel for its ability to expand our empathy. And there's a slow empathy in a novel. Whereas a film gets you bang in there and then you're gone. I mean, films are wonderful. I don't require things of novels. I don't require that they make the most necessary statement about who we are now, for example, that they would sum up what our society is now. I don't require much of either form, perhaps. But I know that they give a lot of things to us. Despite the fact that I'm not asking them to. And I am still passionate about the novel and the short story for its privacy and for how close it is to the reader. There's something about a reader as opposed to a critic. When you're reading, you're in company, and you're in very intimate company. The thing I like about readers is they let a book come close. And there can be moments when you don't let a book come close. But that relationship between writer and reader, to me, is a very special one, because it happens. I know films sometimes happen in the darkness. I am talking off the top of my head. Give me an easy question. Where do you get your shoes? Yeah. There's something incontrovertible about a tradition. I mean, you can discuss it in social historical terms, or you can say there is something about the modesty of the form that suited a country that didn't have a large idea of itself as a society, say. You know, that Jane Austen and George Eliot could write big social novels because England had a big society, whereas ours was too, had been bled too dry, really, for all of that. So that this short story form, Frank O'Connor has a very hazy theory about the short story being about loneliness, and that it's a lonely voice, that the writer is both lonely on the edge of a society like Ireland, and that the characters are essentially, that all short stories are about loneliness. It's a very powerful idea, but I don't know if it actually if it comes out in the wash or not, you know. I grew up with short stories. Frank O'Connor, Mary Lavin, and Fionn O'Fallon were on my parents' bookshelves, and they were on a lot of bookshelves in Ireland, and we thought they were important. It's interesting you say that Mary Lavin has died away in America. All of these, well, O'Connor and Lavin were published in The New Yorker, which was in a very embittered literary scene in Dublin in the 50s and 60s. Was an amazing, 40s and 50s, was an amazingly powerful thing. It was like being assumed bodily into heaven to be published in the New Yorker. And also the strength of the dollar was such you could put your children through school on the proceeds. And Mary Lavin died away in America partly because she wouldn't travel. She wouldn't come over to America. But, I mean, there are reputations don't fall forever. She isn't lost, believe me. Or they don't fade. I don't mean not rather than fall. The short story is a great mystery to me because I love writing short stories, and the reason I love writing short stories is that a short story obliges you to write it. With a novel, you are, to an extent, driving the bus. But with a short story, you write the story and it ends, right? So the power relationship between the writer and the story is completely different. You can't push it or you'll kill it. You know? You just have to accept it. You have to take it on its own terms. So that is what I love about the short story. Also, that the truths it provides are glancing and various. In a country that was very mono in many ways, you know, with the church and whatever, to have this, and nationalism and all kinds of things, that we are all the same in this way, when of course we were, the short story was always various and always coming at different sides and gave a mosaic of experience that I think might have been one of the reasons it survived as a tradition, as a great tradition. I just compiled a book, the Granta Book of the Irish Story. So I was no further on when I finished. I wrote a nice big preface about the short story, and I'm no further on, really. How did I meet him? Trying to think. I know I met him the second time. I asked could I borrow his Problems of Philosophy by George Russell. Sexy or what? I auditioned for him. That's how I met him. I auditioned for a play in Players in Theatre in Trinity College. And in his notes, which I unfortunately are lost, he wrote the word bingo. He gave me the part. It's a long time ago. Thank you for asking. Me in a foreign country. Just a word about Sean, though. I texted some of my girlfriends saying I need a really sexy Irish man's name. The silence went on for days. A really, you know, Rory. So I went through them, and then I said, oh, Sean, you know, just go for the basic. Why can't that be as sexy as anything? On which note, perhaps? Oh, thank you. Yeah, no, I'm just, thank you. Sorry.
Thanks so much for joining us.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.